Welcome, everyone.
I'm really looking forward to Kieran's discussion tonight on the choices, good and bad, that Saul had to make. So Kieran's ready to go. So I'll leave it over to you, Kieran. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming out here and braving the cold tonight. And also hello to those who are at home, snug as a bug in a rug. With a hot chocolate, almost kind of jealous. Probably should have brought a hot chocolate with me. I just wanted to quickly, I wasn't going to talk about this. So I didn't pick out the hymns. Tan picked out the hymns. And that was an absolutely amazing first one, one of my sort of favorite ones. And it just sort of struck me as I was reading it, how amazing sort of the first and the last verse is. Obviously it's repeated, and how sort of alike it is to Saul and Paul eventually. You know, at one point he calls himself a wretch. At one point he was lost, but then he was found. At one point he was blind, but then he saw. And that just sort of struck me as we were singing it, and I had to share it. So as many of you would know by now, I'm not the best when it comes to remembering things, whether it's duties, events, things to do. In all seriousness, if you need me to do something, speak to Tiff, because if you speak to me, it's not going to get done. That wasn't a joke either. That's a genuine serious thing. If you want something, me to do something, please speak to Tiffany. But I remember back to when Phil was doing the first talk, and he sort of mentioned that the overall theme of the year was going to be about choices and decisions. And I remember sitting there thinking, yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a good idea. And I had this brainwave and I thought, you know, hey, Paul would be an amazing character to look at. And then thought, you know, maybe we could have a look through, and surely there Paul was in the syllabus. There was a talk for him. I thought, oh, wow, that's really awesome. That'd be a good one to listen to. And then so there was me doing it. I'm like, wow, that's awesome. This is how it all just came together. I'm really excited to really get a chance to look at this. Paul is one of my absolute favorite characters to speak about and to look at, partially because, I mean, at least half of the New Testament is things that he wrote down, but also just what he's gone through has given me such a lot of encouragement and a lot of strength, and I really can't wait to get stuck into what we're going to look at. So as a bit of a sort of an overview, I wanted to spice it up. So instead of writing overview, we've got a menu. So for our entree, what we're going to look at sort of to start with is a bit of the formative years of Saul. So I want to look at just very briefly the early couple of years, because I think that goes really nicely. It's probably not the right way to phrase it, but really well into this first choice that we'll look at. We're going to look at just three. I could pick out, you know, hundreds of choices that Saul and Paul made over the time, but we'll just limit it to three. I want to look at sort of the context or the circumstance that's happening briefly. We want to look at the decision that he made, and we want to look at maybe some lessons that we can draw out from it, whether it's drawing it out from Paul himself or whether it's, you know, things that are happening around. Realistically, we could probably spend, you know, a night looking at his life as Saul and a night looking at his life as Paul. Don't worry though, I will stick to the time. So that's kind of our main course. And then our dessert that we're going to have at the end is we're going to look at just some overall lessons and themes that I think that Paul can teach us, that he's brought out throughout his life. And that's going to be sort of made up of other little parts of his life, and then also those three choices. The other thing I wanted to make mention just before we get jumping into it is that I might get myself confused when I'm talking about Paul and Saul. So please, if I say the wrong one, don't say anything. But obviously, I'll try and refer to Saul as when he was actually referred to as Saul, and vice versa for Paul. I think Saul kind of has maybe a bad connotation with the name. When we think of Saul, we tend to think of, I guess, what we're going to look at for our first choice, spoilers. But he was still known as Saul sort of after his conversion and still did things and was known as Saul after that. So we won't look at those necessarily, but I just wanted to sort of briefly mention that. So the reason, as I said before, is just so that we can get sort of an understanding of Saul and what he grew up in and what he grew up with around what's going on. So we don't know sort of exactly when he was born. We don't know when he died exactly, but we have sort of rough estimate of what was going on. There's an idea that he was about 30 years old when Stephen was killed. That's sort of based on the language that was used in the Greek. I didn't understand it, of course, but I took other people's word for it. And then basically counting back, 30 years, roughly would have been only a few years younger than Jesus. The reason why I'm putting that on the screen is because that kind of blew me away a little bit. Whenever I thought of Saul and Paul, I always, for some reason in my mind, thought, he was so much, born so much later than Jesus, but no, he wasn't. It was only a couple of years difference there. So they are kind of contemporaries, I guess. Saul would have grown up, he would have been, perhaps in Jerusalem, and Jesus perhaps would have been there. Perhaps they met, perhaps they had seen each other at some particular point. So we don't know sort of a lot about Saul's early life because it really isn't that important. But from his own words, so he became a Pharisee and studied under Gamaliel. We'll talk a little bit about him in a second. So as I said before, based off sort of rough timelines, Saul would have been studying or at least in Jerusalem around the time of Jesus' teaching there. He would have heard about the miracles. He would have heard about the parables. And he would have been able to see that immense power, that incredible power that Jesus had. And whether he physically saw Jesus or didn't, I think it adds that extra bit of layer that he would have known about who Jesus was. He wasn't sort of stuck in Tarsus or anything. He would have been there right when this was all kicking off. And the last point that I want to mention is that he was a devout, dedicated, and strong-willed individual. And this is all looking at someone who's about 30 years old. So we just want to have a quick look at those two verses. You don't have to turn them up. I've got them on the screen. But we've got there that this is Paul, describing himself, saying that he was circumcised the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. As to the law, a Pharisee. As to zeal, a persecutor of the ecclesia. As to righteousness under the law, blameless. So if you just pick out like a couple of phrases there, he really looks at that zeal. Obviously, that zeal channeled into very much the wrong area. And he's looking at sort of that righteousness under the law, blameless. If we look at that next verse, verse in Galatians, and I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people, so extremely zealous was I for the traditions of the Father. So we can see just how dedicated Saul was right from a sort of a young age at learning things from the Bible, admittedly from a sort of a Pharisee's point of view and very much looking at the law, but still very committed to what he's doing. So you can see here he's talking in both sort of about his zeal that he has, still mentioning sort of the atrocities that he was going to commit not shying away from them, but still bringing them up. And we can see there that he'd advanced beyond many of his own age. This was someone who knew what he was talking about or thought he knew what he was talking about. And it's also talking sort of about the traditions there as well. Whether Saul believed Jesus or not, when Jesus died on that cross, hung on that tree, that would have pushed him away. Because we know that according to the law, cursed is anyone who hangs on the tree. How could this man, how could Jesus, who proclaimed himself to be God, or the Son of God, be cursed? That just wouldn't be able to work out in Saul's mind. It went against all the traditions that he held, and so it wouldn't have been right. And I think that was perhaps something that drew him to perhaps some of his actions later. So I just wanted to briefly look through just that little bit of Saul's sort of early life and just how devoted and how intense he was just as a studier. And it's about to get a whole lot more intense. So the first choice that we're going to have a look at is not a great one. And it was his persecution of believers that he committed. Again, remembering he was about 30 years old when he did this, which kind of hit home to me, not only because he was referred to as a young man, which gives me hope, but also, you know, this is someone a couple of years older than me who was doing these things. So we got there that Saul approved the execution, the unlawful execution of God, because, of course, the Jews didn't have the power to do this kind of stuff. We know from when Jesus was born, was crucified, it had to be through the Romans. They couldn't just grab him. They couldn't just hurl some stones at him. They had to be sort of the proper way done. If you wanted this man dead, the Romans had to do it. Instead, here, when we look at it, if you have, well, maybe turn up Acts 7, and we can just have a quick look at this briefly. From what I'm looking at, it looks more like it was just sort of that mob mentality. So Acts 7, and I'm looking sort of at verse 54. Let's read those couple of verses there, because it kind of really hits home. So Acts 7 from verse 54. Now when they heard these things, these are all the things that Stephen's just been talking about, they were enraged and they ground their teeth at him. But he, full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And he said, "Behold, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." But they cried out with a loud voice and stopped their ears and rushed together at him. And they cast him out in the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul. And then if we just jump down to verse 1 of chapter 8, and Saul approved of this execution. They just went for it, basically. In Saul approving this, even though he didn't throw any physical stones, he effectively threw them all. He was having his word on all of these stones and his power behind it. And if we look at those thrown stones, we look at Stephen's death. There came a great persecution of the Christians there, those of Christ, as we continue to read in Acts chapter 8, causing them to scatter from Jerusalem and into the various regions around the place. Unwittingly, Saul had basically helped spread the gospel, something that at a later stage he would do willingly and lovingly, but at this stage he's sort of spreading it through his own bad choices. He disregarded the advice of his teacher, which I think is pretty interesting. So if you just flick back to Acts chapter 5, we'll just have a couple of looks there. So Acts 5 and verse 34 this time. But a Pharisee in the council named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law held in honor by all the people, stood up and gave orders to put the men outside for a little while. And he said to them, "Men of Israel, take care what you are about to do with these men. For before these days, Theudas arose up, claiming to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him. He was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean rose up in the days of the census and drew away some of the people after him. He too perished, and all who followed him were scattered. So in the present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone. If this be, for if this plan or this undertaking is of men, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God." And so basically they took his advice and they didn't kill him. They killed the apostles here. They just beat them up. But in looking at it, he's disregarded what everyone else at that time had accepted. We don't know who the first person is, who Theudas is. We have some idea of who Judas the Galilean was. Basically, he just led a revolt and he ended up getting crushed. Despite the number of the Sanhedrin here and seemingly being the only voice that raises up to not kill these apostles, he says that God should do the judging. If this is a revolution of man, he says, it's going to fail. But if it's God's plan, then it's who can stop it? And in trying to stop it, you're going to be going against God himself. The people listened then, but Saul chose to ignore those words later on And we see that he really came at a loggerheads with God and with God's purpose before things were turned around. But the biggest choice that Saul decided to make here, and this is really this first choice that we're going to look at, is what was done in verse 3 of Acts chapter 8. But Saul was ravaging the ecclesia, and entering house after house, he dragged off men and women and committed them to prison. Basically, he's just going through and absolutely destroying the believers, tearing through like a wild beast would a flock of sheep. A deliberate choice, of course, because the ecclesia is God's flock. He would have absolutely ripped through it, and there's no wonder that people scattered and ran for their lives. If we're looking there, he went from house to house. He wasn't doing things by half measures. No, he wanted all of these believers gone. He wasn't leaving one house left unturned if there was even the possibility of there being any Christians there. And we can see there that he committed them to prison. Now, when I was younger, I used to always just read that and think, oh, okay, they're just going to prison. That's not too bad. But no, it was going to prison and then to death as well. And we read that a bit later on when Paul's talking about it later on, that he cast his vote against them for death. Despite his standing back at Stephen's stoning, I believe that Saul would have been sort of making some appearances with these raids. Him traveling up to Damascus, which another spoiler alert we'll talk about in a second, shows that to me as well. Paul was a man of action where possible. He's not going to be doing things by half measures. He's going to be doing the house to house. He's going to be there sorting this out himself. Wherever the Christians are, Saul would also be there. So we have this idea here of this man being an absolute maniac. Someone so enraged, so full of fire, that he's going around like a tornado, leaving death and destruction in his path. And so that's the decision that Saul made after hearing Stephen's speech. Saul went on the offensive, violently persecuting followers of Christ for exactly that reason. Their only crime was that they were worshipping God. So what are some things that we can sort of pick out from this? The first one is, and obviously I'm not meaning literally here, but we shouldn't ravage our own ecclesia here or elsewhere. We need to be ensuring that we're listening properly and that we're not sort of jumping to conclusions or metaphorically casting people away and scattering them. We need to be here. We're all brothers and sisters. We need to make sure that we're all here for each other and not ravaging the ecclesia. The other point that I want to get, not so much from what Saul did, but from what the believers did as they were chased away. So if we look at, let me just go back there to grab the verse. In Acts chapter 8, the people that were scattered apart, they didn't just sort of idly sit by. They're in a different land and go there. No, if we read Acts chapter 8 and verse 4, now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. These were people who moments ago, days, weeks, months ago, had been fearing for their lives, literally chased out of their house, for believing in God, for worshipping God. And yet here they were preaching the word to anyone who would listen. This shows just tremendous faith, faith that I look at in amazement, given how I would have reacted and how I have reacted in easier conditions. We need to preach, not concerned about perhaps the circumstances that surround us, but preach because we feel compelled to. Preach because that's the thing that we need to do. So that's just a look at that first sort of choice that I wanted to look at, one of the big ones. And the second one, which we've already given it away and is perhaps the obvious one, but is on his way to Damascus. So if we continue sort of reading on in Acts, the next time that we speak of or hear of Saul is in Acts chapter 9. It'd be a place that we're all very familiar with. It's sort of something we learned from in Sunday school right from the very beginning. So effectively, Saul here is still ravaging the ecclesia. He's still going from house to house. He's still taking people to prison. But eventually, people are either going to leave or he's going to have captured all of them and sort of taken them to prison. Saul approaches the high priest. He's not content with the work that he's done in Jerusalem. He goes to the high priest himself. He's asking for letters addressed to the synagogues in Damascus that allow Saul to bring back those Christians back to Jerusalem and to a fate similar to like their captured brothers and sisters. We don't know exactly what the papers were, whether they had sort of any power behind them, but given that they're going with Saul, who has shown himself to be sort of a man of on a mission and willing to do things, I'm sure that probably wouldn't have mattered. And if we're looking at it as well, it's a pretty massive journey. And that just shows to me sort of how ruthless at this time Saul was. It's roughly 217 kilometers, which nowadays might not seem like it's that much. But back then, that's like a six-day journey. So I was curious as to sort of how far that would be. So I don't know if you can see that necessarily, and Keith's not here, so I can't make a Keith joke. But essentially, that would be like driving from here, right at this hall, to Keith. That's how far away Saul was willing to persecute the believers. If we were going to look at it from how a bird flies, that little red dot up there is roughly where Renmark is. That's how far Saul was willing to go to persecute these people. That's a long way. Like, even if we drive to those places, we're still talking, you know, a couple of hours. We're talking 6 days journey that he took just so that he could get rid of these believers and into a completely different country as well. Yet he does so. So blinded is he by his rage and his need to root out each and every Christian. Again, it's sort of a deliberate turn of phrase because he went from being blind, stubborn, to just plain blind. We know the story, so we're not going to sort of spend a lot of time looking at it. But he's traveling along probably close to Damascus and blinded, literally by this bright light coming out from heaven. Saul alone heard those words and saw what was happening. The people that were with him, they didn't. They just heard that there were sounds. He heard those words. He heard that he was really persecuting Jesus. Now, this, in my mind, I guess, would have been the clincher for Saul, in that here Jesus had died, and yet Saul was there talking with him. Saul was there physically hearing Jesus talk and speak. Dead men don't speak. So the only possibility is that the apostles must have been right, and that Jesus truly had been raised, and that he truly was the Son of God. And I can just imagine Saul's mind would have been going 1,001,000 miles an hour. The ESV doesn't specifically have this, but the King James adds in that Saul asks Jesus what to do. He would have known that it was Jesus speaking to him. He would have recognized him. So he's told to just enter the city and to wait there. Just like that, the light's gone. The light disappears and everything's back to normal, aside from his lost vision. So he's led into the city and he spends 3 days there. 3 days in darkness, just sitting. Doesn't even eat, doesn't drink. He's just sitting there and thinking. His mind would have been spinning and trying to figure out what's going on. And so this is the choice that he had to make. Was he going to humbly submit himself to God's plan, or would he selfishly continue with his own plan? To selfishly continue to kick against the pricks and to be that stubborn animal. It might be easy sort of sitting here and thinking that, well, obviously there's only one option to pick. You know, you've just had this bright light shine down. Surely that's the only place, only thing to do. But how many times do we read through the Bible, and you can possibly think of your own time, where we have examples of believers and non-believers witnessing great miracles, but they weren't swayed in their thinking? So I've got just a couple there on the screen. If we think of Pharaoh had to have 10 plagues brought upon him, and it literally took the death of his firstborn for him to relent momentarily. The 12 spies, they would have witnessed all the wonders that happened in Egypt. They would have witnessed all those plagues. They would have seen them cross the Red Sea, travel across the wilderness. And yet they were terrified. They couldn't stomach the fight and wanted to do things their own way. And let's not forget the number of Jews that would have all heard, they would have witnessed the sheer power that Jesus had, unparalleled to any, and clearly the Son of God, as he was saying. Yet plenty did nothing, and others, the Pharisees in particular, plotted to have him killed. They had their own selfish plans. They didn't line up with what God was wanting to do, and so they decided to follow their own plan. We obviously know that Saul decided to repent. Saul decided to choose to humble himself, to be as God's vessel, as Ananias was told. So what are some lessons that we can learn from this choice, the positive, the good choice that Saul made? The first one, obviously, is we have ultimately the same choice that Saul has. We might not witness miracles. We might not have great beams of light coming down from heaven with Jesus' name, our voice calling out to us. But it's still a choice that we have to each make. And speaking for myself, I don't always pick the right option. It's something that we all need to work on. I need to work on a lot. We need to ensure that we're continually trying to humble ourselves to God and to submit to his will. We don't want to be that pig-headed, stubborn Saul of old. And the second one, again, not necessarily learning from Saul, but it's what Ananias did. He's told to go lay hands on Saul to give him back his sight. Saul, the man who had gone through and would have killed off his brothers, his sisters. There was obviously some hesitation at the beginning. He was fearful for his life in going to such a notorious man whose infamy would have traveled far before him. And yet Ananias humbles himself, and he does as he's commanded. Again, we see an incredible level of faith and a real testament to what we should be trying to do. He doesn't know what's going to happen when he goes to Saul. He doesn't know whether he's going to live or die. He just has to trust in God. And that's what he does. He puts his complete trust in God, that God will protect him, or that if the worst is going to happen, that God would raise him. And I think that we can learn a lot from Ananias. We're not going to look at him necessarily, but the sheer faith that he had and confidence that if the worst was going to happen, then in the end it would be okay. So I could have picked sort of a number of other choices that Saul slash Paul made. But ultimately, I wanted to pick this one just because it intrigued me so much. So if we just jump across, we spent sort of a little bit of time over in the latter part of Acts. So we'll start off sort of in Acts 25 and we'll work our way roughly through. We see here, we've sort of skipped over a large portion of Paul's life. He's gone on three journeys. He's preached the gospel to numerous, numerous people, set up ecclesias almost everywhere that he's gone. And here he is being spoken to. So if we look at Acts 25, we can see that Paul appealed to Caesar, as his right was as a Roman citizen, instead of going to Jerusalem and being tried before Festus, the Roman governor. He did so for a couple of reasons. Partially to avoid the Jewish leaders who would press to execute him, but also to spread the gospel further, which had been his lifelong mission from after his conversion. And if we look back a couple of chapters earlier, Acts 23, we've got it on the screen there. This is Jesus speaking to Paul. He says, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." Paul knew that ultimately he's going to have to get to Rome. It was time to take the gospel and Christianity to that next level, away from the epicenter of Jerusalem and to the very palace, perhaps even the very presence of the most powerful ruler of the day, Nero, whose sway over the land would have been absolutely enormous. We see this later with Constantine, just what happens when one ruler of a massive empire can do in changing the entire course of history. And if we look at a little bit later, we've got there when he was writing Philippians, he sort of ends it with this little comment there. "All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household," which I think, we won't go there yet, I think is just absolutely amazing. Whether it's, you know, physically members of the household or not, we don't know. I would guess probably not. But it's still being able to get right to that palace, right to people working at the palace, in and around that palace, who've become believers and been baptized. This is what Paul had to do. As we touched on earlier, and we've got that sort of highlighted there with the Caesar's household, we touched on it earlier as well. Paul's not really trying to escape death here. If you read through verse 11 of Acts 25, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to these their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar. Paul knows that whether he's going to die in Rome is irrelevant. Everyone has to die at some stage. Paul here is showing his own integrity, that if he's found guilty, he's not going to try and avoid it. He knows, though, that his only crime has been worshipping God. Coincidentally, that's a reversal of his earlier life. If you remember back, the brothers and sisters, his brothers and sisters now, were committing the exact same offense. Their only crime was that they were followers of God and that they were believing. When he tore through them like that wild beast, and now he's having to endure the same thing, being persecuted by the same group of people, perhaps the same group of people he grew up with or that he studied with. And so just like that, Paul's plucked up from the hands of those plotting against his death and eventually brought into Rome, into that presence of power, perhaps not to the emperor himself, but certainly a group of officials who would have had the emperor's ear. Here he had the opportunity to spread that gospel as he did vastly throughout that entire region and continue to spread it, which has continued to spread throughout the rest of the world to how we have it now. So what can we learn from this little episode and the choice here that Paul made to appeal to Caesar, to go and travel up to Rome and speak to him? The first one is that obviously we talked about the integrity that he had. That if he was found guilty, he would accept it. And I think we can learn that from ourselves as well, to put into our own lives, that we should always try and show integrity in our own life, regardless of the consequences. Paul, even though he knew that he'd done nothing wrong and that there were no legal bounds for him to be executed, would still accept it. He didn't act foolishly, though. He didn't allow himself to be taken and tried in Jerusalem, but he still wouldn't refuse that guilty verdict. And the second lesson, and this is something that Paul tells us later on, coincidentally to a letter to those in Rome, is that all things work together for good. And if you can remember back to, I think it was Sunday night, I sort of said that this was my favorite section of the Bible. It might be difficult at times to maybe see it, but it does happen, that all things work together for good. Put yourself in Paul's sandals. You've just appealed to Caesar, and you have no idea how that's going to play out. You don't know what the future holds, and you don't know what the appeal process is going to be like. And yet through this whole process, through this journey, Paul ends up spreading the gospel further and further, bringing it even into that residence of Nero himself. And if we had have read a few verses earlier in Romans chapter 8, we would have read that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glory that's going to be revealed to us. Paul, especially in his imprisonment and with his impending death later on, would have taken great comfort in this, I'm sure, that no matter what was going to happen to him, the kingdom of God would just be so much better. So in looking through all of that, and I've given away what I'm going to talk about, I want to look just quickly at what Paul can teach us. What has he taught us throughout his life and all the decisions and the choices that he's made, whether good or bad? The first one that I want to talk about is, and I brought it out with that first verse where he was talking about the zeal that he had and the persecution that he committed. He committed some terrible atrocities against his future brothers and sisters. And yet he doesn't shy away from his mistakes. He doesn't try and hide it away and pretend that nothing happened. We read earlier, and I pointed this out right at the very beginning, he calls himself a wretched man at one point. And yet through those mistakes, he grows. The same goes for us too. We're not perfect. We make mistakes, whether they're big ones or small ones. And it's okay to make some mistakes, but we need to grow from that experience, and we need to use it as a lesson to try and continue to build our faith. He kept his passion and his zeal throughout his life. Yes, at the beginning, the zeal that he had was used terribly for selfish reasons, and yet he still had that zeal, and that continued all the way through with his interactions and his journeys with people. So a question for us, how's our passion for Christ now? Sometimes for me personally, yeah, sometimes it burns bright. But then there are other times where it lacks. Paul's really shown me and shown me what it needs to be like at certain times. And it's given me a good reminder of how passionate I should strive to be. And the last one there is that we see this massive change. We see Saul going from that wild, ravenous man to a humble servant. This gives me the absolute greatest encouragement that with God, all things are possible. Sin is sin in God's eyes. It doesn't matter what we've done, it's still sin. God hates it. But the absolute forgiveness that Paul receives demonstrates just how absolutely forgiving God is if you just ask for it and repent. There's no limits to his forgiveness. Although Paul warns us in Romans 6 that we shouldn't continue in sin. We need to make that real change in our lives to go from selfish human thinking to a humble, God-fearing servant willing to do anything for him. So that's really been sort of a whirlwind tour of looking at Saul, looking at Paul, and just a couple of his choices and his decisions that he made, whether it was good or bad. I find him such an inspiring character with all these many lessons that we can implement in our own lives. And I'll just keep that up on the screen because I think that's a really good way to sort of finish this up.